Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Gargi, and today I have with me Professor Sanjay Krishnan, who teaches at Boston University in the U.S. He is author of many books, most recent of which is V.S. Naipaul's Journeys from Periphery to Center, published with the Columbia University Press. Hello, Professor Krishnan. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. As always, I'd like to start with the beginning. What is the genesis of this book? How did this book came to be?
I had been reading Naipaul for some time, and my initial experience of him was that he was quite an eye-opening writer. I found him shocking in parts. You know, I was very moved by some of what he wrote. But my initial experience of Naipaul was very much a personal one. He really kind of rocked my world at first. And this had nothing to do with my intellectual interests in the sense that, you know, I was still, an undergraduate and actually I started reading him before undergraduate years. And then I stopped reading him for a while because as I became more intellectually aware, I realized that people were criticizing him for his political views, for what he said about, you know, non-Europeans and so forth. So over a period of time, I sort of circled back to Naipaul to sort of ask myself why it was that I had been so moved by him as a young person, if in fact everything he said was so bad, if in fact he was such an awful writer and an awful person. And so this sort of led me to sort of reread his work. And in the process, I developed a very different perspective on him, which had to do with his own sort of historical formation, if you like. So that was the genesis of the idea, an attempt to sort of revisit some of the early experiences of Naipaul in light of what I had sort of become aware of through a more sort of self-consciously scholarly and intellectual trajectory in graduate school.
Yeah, I think this book can also be read as a biography of the author. Is it, however, meant to be read as a biography?
That's a good question. I don't think it's meant to be read as a biography because the focus of the writing is the work. I'm really trying to engage with his ideas and also with his artistic enterprise. So I'm really focused on showing how an understanding of the life can illuminate the art, if you like. Not so much I'm not trying to tell Naipaul's life story. I do think, however, that the life story is important. And this is something that people who are very critical of Naipaul miss. They don't get it. They don't, because they're so focused on a kind of an ideological position or a sort of a framework of, you know, which is defined by post-colonial studies, that they can't enter into the perspective from which Naipaul was writing. So for that reason, the life aspect of it was very important to sort of situate Naipaul in his time and place and to show how that history and that formation were fundamental to the kind of art that he produced.
Significant here is also the theme of travel, which is in the title of this book. How important is for a critic who wants to analyze his work to consider the travel in his writing or his travels?
I think the travel is very important. Naipaul says somewhere that, you know, his early years as a writer were very informed by the European tradition of the novel form. And, you know, growing up in Trinidad in a colony, that was all he had to sort of build upon as a writer. But this was a very limited, this European tradition of the novel form, you know, whether it was Balzac or Dickens or Stendhal, gave him a very particularistic or a very narrow view of the world. And so travel actually filled out a kind of a broader understanding of the kind of history that he had been born into. And because when he was growing up, there were very few books that had been written about the colonial periphery from the perspective of people with his background, indentured immigrants, for instance. He couldn't really just go to some library or seek out a place from which he could learn about or fill out that broader view. And so he was forced to actually, he felt compelled to begin by traveling. And if you look at his trajectory, he begins his travels really within the West Indies. You know, he writes his first travelogue about 5 Caribbean islands, and then he sort of expands from there to India, which is his ancestral birthplace, and then beyond that to other parts of the world. So there's a gradual sort of opening out. He builds on what he actually knows, which is at first the West Indian world, and then in a different way the South Asian universe, and then from that he kind of fills out his universe, his understanding through reading history and comes to a broader perspective on the world. And this comes to enrich his own fictional work. So there's a kind of a recursive aspect to the process.
And important here is also the subtitle, which is also about the movement from periphery to the center. Can you elaborate what you mean by, what does this movement from the periphery to center entail?
I think it can mean different things. I think at one level, you know, the most obvious level, Naipaul moves from the periphery to the center. He was born into an underprivileged economically disadvantaged background, and his career culminated in his being awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, which is as prestigious an award as you can imagine in the world of literature. So he does move from the periphery to the center, in that sense. I think there's also a way in which his own sort of writing moves from an examination of peripheral spaces such as the one that I described to metropolitan spaces, including England, as he does in The Enigma of Arrival and other works, other late sort of works. So that, if you think of like fiction, Half a Life and so forth. And so there is a sense in which, he's sort of moving from the periphery to the center as part of his own examining of his formation and his connection to people with backgrounds similar to his own. I think it's also from periphery to center in the sense that Naipaul appears to be writing about marginalized and historically subjected people, but it turns out that the perspective he brings to bear on these questions actually have a more fundamental and a more sort of central impact on the 21st century, the global 21st century, because so much of the periphery has also moved to the center in many different ways, whether in terms of historical themes, migrations, political overlaps, and so forth. The periphery and the center are no longer as divided or as separate as they might once have been thought to be.
Yeah, and a lot of people who read V.S. Naipaul would be aware of how critical he was about non-European societies. And in the book, you claim that these statements should be placed in the context of his seriously writerly engagement. Can you give an example of how that would work?
Sure. Well, you know, there are many examples of this. One example that comes to mind is the way in which Naipaul was trying to understand why the optimism he felt as about post-colonial spaces, including Trinidad, his birthplace, why the initial optimism he felt about the creation of an inclusive national culture did not pan out, and what that said about his own lack of understanding about his formation. So he attempted as a writer to sort of make sense of this failure of understanding, and the writerly sort of project led him to a far more critical perspective on the way in which identities were being shaped and the ways in which identities were being understood within nationalist discourses, and how the failure to sort of reflect critically on the histories by which these identities had been produced fed into a kind of a growing sort of toxic blend of ethno-nationalism and nativism in different places. So the criticism that Naipaul sort of produces in his writings have a lot to do with the very early appreciation for the way in which post-colonial identity politics would go. This very early intuition that Naipaul had, and he had it as early as 1960, 1961, was really denied by post-colonialists and post-colonial scholars. If you look at post-colonial studies, there is really very little appreciation of this until the 1990s. You know, it's only when Rwanda and all these issues begin to sort of come to the fore that people begin to say, oh, you know, maybe this is something we ought to talk about. For the longest time, I think, especially in post-colonial studies, decolonization was seen as an act of moral rebalancing rather than a political process that was fraught with danger. And I think Naipaul was to some extent punished for not sort of towing this line, because there was a sense in which to sort of argue in a critical, to look at the more complex aspects of this process was to be guilty of blaming the victim, which is not what I think Naipaul was doing, you know, in his writing. And so this is why he came to be understood as a very anti-European or a kind of a pro-Western or Eurocentric writer, which is a misunderstanding, as I argue in the book.
And why was that? Why was this reluctance in post-colonialism to accept the criticisms that they were getting from several quarters, not just now?
Well, this is a very complex story. I don't know if I can sort of give you a full explanation. But one thing I will sort of point out is that the main, the most important figure within post-colonial studies was Edward Said. And Edward Said was very, very critical of Naipaul. He was very opposed to everything that Naipaul wrote. And if you look at Said's own position and Said's own intellectual formation, it's very clear that he drew inspiration from the anti-colonial nationalist movement or anti-colonial nationalist ideology as it was articulated by Frantz Fanon, and particularly the Fanon of the Wretched of the Earth. So, you know, so Said's understanding of post-colonialism was very much shaped by Fanon, and post-colonial studies as it developed was drawing very much from the Saidian influence. And I think that Said really saw took to heart the binarisms of anti-colonial nationalism and sought to import it into post-colonial studies. So he made post-colonial studies into an essential sort of binaristic sort of understanding of oppressors and oppressed. He wasn't really very interested in exploring the unevennesses, the fractures, the tensions within the colonized communities, the uneven ways in which colonialism affected different groups, the ways in which literary texts were very much engaged in exploring them, the ways in which ethnic minorities experienced nationalism in different ways than did the majority populations. These were questions that were, I think, really flattened out by the Saidian analysis in culture and imperialism in particular. Even though he sort of makes gestures at these points, he doesn't really sort of enter into these terms, and so post-colonial studies becomes an increasingly sort of moralizing in its approach. It sort of comes to reify resistance as the sole template through which the past is to be addressed, right? So what I think of as a historical analysis of the sort that Naipaul was providing, and Naipaul was a flawed writer, he wasn't sort of perfect, was no longer legible to the post-colonial approach, because the post-colonial needed to sort of understand the world in a certain way. Naipaul didn't fit that sort of the template, and so he fell afoul of the post-colonial approach. And one concern I do have about the post-colonial approach in that sense is the way in which the moralizing framework of resistance sort of seems to sort of excuse people from make people think that they don't need to sort of understand the historicity and the specificity of different political terrains. They can simply sort of substitute that with a kind of moralizing critique, which is what Naipaul was not interested in.
And you have divided Naipaul's career into three phases. And so the first is from 1955 to 1961, then from 62 to 80, and then from 81 to 2010. Before we talk about these phases, I want to ask you, why is there a need to do this?
For the most part, it was because I think Naipaul's, these were the divisions or the breaks that I saw in Naipaul's own formation as a writer. I think the early period, the early phase that you just identified, was really a phase in which Naipaul was shifting from a primarily sort of the kind of European formation, European training he would have had as a student in a Queen's Royal College in Trinidad, in doing everything he could to win a scholarship to study at the University of Oxford. And it was very difficult to get that scholarship. Only one scholarship was awarded every year when he was taking the exam. So he had to sort of, as it were, immerse himself in a kind of a European thinking. And the same thing happened at Oxford. And so he really didn't, when he began his career as a writer, he was primarily a sort of a comic writer, a writer who was sort of not really as well informed about the histories of the non-West. And I think that the early phase of his career was very much about him sort of moving towards a more sort of nuanced sort of appreciation for the historical developments that were taking place around the world at the time. This was the era of decolonization, and so the period from 62 to 80 is when Naipaul actually sort of really sort of immerses himself in a more sort of non-European context. And his initial response sort of actually led him to quite a dark vision of the Third World. I think it culminates in the 70s in works like In a Free State and In a Bend in the River. And it's really, I think something he's done with that particular phase with A Bend in the River, because he sort of starts moving towards a more sort of a richer and more sort of complex vision of the non-European world in the 80s, because he's much more interested in looking for how people make a way in the world, to sort of adapt a phrase from one of his late works. He's no longer sort of thinking about decolonization as this process that has to be understood objectively and sort of given shape through literature, particularly as it has an impact on minority populations, on displaced peoples and so forth, to really thinking about the different kinds of conversations that emerge in the third world or in the non-European world that are often sort of quite affirming. So the three phases, I think, sort of align with his own development. The third phase is really the phase in which Naipaul is more self-critical. He's much not self-critical in self-critical in the sense that he's able to sort of make fun of himself more than he is in the second phase, and is able to sort of bring in more voices. It's a much more richer sort of play of voices in the third phase of his career.
And you highlight a very important contradiction in how Naipaul is considered by the critics. And as an Indian, I was surprised when you said in 1970 he was called an anti-Hindu Brown Sahib, but today he is sometimes linked to as an apology for Hindu chauvinism and Islamophobia. Why is there so much of contradiction within the critics themselves too?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that people don't really read very closely. And people, because, you know, as I said, you know, when you have a moralizing template, when your analysis is driven by ideological considerations, you tend to flatten out complexity. And I think that Naipaul, for a long time, because of the way in which post-colonialists sought to sort of brand him, Naipaul was someone whom you knew what he was saying before you had even read him, is what he had come to represent, I think, for a certain kind of critic. And so this obvious contradiction between how Naipaul was branded anti-Hindu and then later as a Hindu fundamentalist or a Hindu nationalist is something that really escapes people because they don't read Naipaul, what Naipaul wrote. Rather, they seek to project onto Naipaul their own sort of perceptions of what Naipaul must be saying in his work. So my advice to people as a literary critic and as a scholar is to read closely, to focus on the words on the page rather than bring ideological projections onto bear on your readings, which distort the experience itself.
Yeah, and I interpret it from your book that you're trying to make a distinction between Naipaul as someone Islamophobic or Hindu chauvinistic and Naipaul who sometimes, as you said it, got things wrong. And is this interpretation correct, or I'm wrong here?
Sometimes he got things wrong and sometimes he was Islamophobic. Is that what you're saying?
You're saying that, you know, I read it that he's not Islamophobic, he's not Hindu chauvinistic, but then he did get things wrong.
Oh, I see. I mean, I think, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Yes, I think that's right, yeah.
I mean, my question would be then, why is there need for making this distinction that even though he did get things wrong, he's not chauvinistic, he's not Islamophobic, or any other terms that you can make up.
So let me, I think these words like Islamophobic and chauvinistic are words that are that they signal a particular kind of position, I think. And, someone who sort of, has worked out a certain kind of position on Islam and is sort of interested in propagating it in a programmatic way. That's how I understand it, an Islamophobe, for instance. Or a chauvinist is someone who is ideologically convinced of the superiority of their race or their culture or their religion and seeks to sort of write in order to advocate for that view at the expense of other groups. Now, Naipaul was not any of those things. However, and it's important to remember this, particularly for post-colonial scholars, Naipaul was shaped by the prejudices of his time. That is to say, he was a person who grew up in the colonial periphery. What people who have this sort of hygienic view of the colonized do not understand is that all colonial spaces, all colonized spaces are informed by prejudice, profound forms of historical tensions or cultural misunderstandings or a failure to enter into the spaces of different groups. This is, for anyone who has grown up in a colonial space or a post-colonial space, this is not a mystery, right? So what I think of as Naipaul from that standpoint is a kind of everyman. That is to say, the prejudices that he possesses inform a wider swathe of post-colonial society than we are often willing to acknowledge. And that he is actually attempting to sort of write out of those prejudices. That is to say, he is reflecting the complicit ways in which his writing is being produced in his own sort of work. So when he gets things wrong, if we sort of try to say, oh, look, here's the chauvinistic Naipaul, or here is the, you know, racist Naipaul, what we have done is we've missed or lost an opportunity to reflect critically on the ways in which Naipaul may be channeling or exposing or reflecting on a much wider predicament within post-colonial society. So if our intention is not to sort of moralize and to be self-righteous, then we sort of move towards a more capacious way of reading, not just Naipaul, but all literatures that allow us to sort of build a more robust, critical, and more reflective discourse. So that would be my response to the question that you posed, which is a good one, yeah.
No, I think you completely answered the question that I had. What do you hope the readers take from this book? What do you hope the change is if when people read this book and in the future of in academia when they're writing about Naipaul?
You know, it's, well, first of all, I think that people, I suppose the most immediate thing is that, you know, that the kind of simplistic readings of Naipaul should really, I think, stop, because they actually they do a disservice to the people who attack Naipaul without having really read him. And this is true of many people, as I point out in the book. I think the broader issue is, you know, something I've already alluded to, which is that Naipaul was actually sort of pointing to certain fault lines within post-colonial societies that I think scholars or critics who are interested in these issues would do well to pay attention to, particularly because I think in the 21st century, Naipaul has very interesting things to say about, you know, how we can sort of revive or retrieve certain forms of cultural analysis that are more reflective, more open to historical understanding than we have, you know, than we have so far thought possible.
Yeah, I hope so too. Since this book was now published almost 2 years ago, I'd also like to talk about your current projects. What are you writing now? What can we hope to read from you?
Yeah, I am actually, so I'm working on some of the issues that I'm working on right now have to do with trying to sort of rethink post-colonial studies by opening up the category of resistance by sort of saying, well, how did resistance become so central to post-colonial studies? You know, why is it that, you know, it's sort of become a kind of a reified framework through which literature is read? And I think what I'm trying to do is sort of try to provide an alternative sort of way of understanding what novels are doing vis-a-vis imperialism, which is not just about, you know, that they're not just engaged in, you know, the project of writing back to empire, but they're doing something much more complicated that, if taken seriously, can sort of feed a richer discourse, that will help the post-colonial, world sort of expand its categories, sort of enrich its terms of discussion. It's really an attempt to sort of look at a number of post-colonial novels to see how they complicate the story of post-colonial studies, post-colonial literature.
That sounds like a fascinating project. And thank you for taking out your time and wish you the best of luck. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.